Test. Sounds like it's working. Check 1, 2, test. Is everyone hearing me over Zoom? Yep, getting a thumbs up now. Cool. Okay, check. And Mr. Adam T. Smith, since I see you were so quick to raise your hand, would be so kind as to speak for us to see if we can hear you?
Sure, can you hear me now?
Okay, we're getting over the speakers. Try that, USB, 3 USB. Could we try again, Adam?
Can you hear me now?
Nope.
I can. There's somebody else online. Easily hear him.
USB into here.
Okay.
You're talking about in the actual computer?
In your Zoom settings, you should just choose USB audio.
It's some USB audio right here. I didn't put you muted. All right, might be able to get someone in Zoom to speak again.
Testing, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
All right.
Okay, you can hear us. We just can't hear you guys right now over the speakers in the room.
Okay.
Are USB audio in and out?
No. Yeah.
We're just not going to get out of the room.
Okay, if someone could speak again over Zoom again once more. Sorry about that.
Can you hear me? Are you hearing me?
I can hear you, Adam.
Thanks, Andrew. I think that they can't hear us in the room.
Probably not, because we heard it here. But I didn't hear it there just now. HDMI out from the Zoom, maybe that will get us another option.
NDI audio?
I don't know if there is. So the HDBS.
It's coming from here into that computer. We have the settings correct, so it should be working, right?
But that computer is not sending it back out. Through the USB.
Oh, so where's the other port?
They're just going through the USB. There's an in and out. There's an adapter in there that says so.
This adapter?
Where's the audio panel? Are you seeing? When somebody talks, are you seeing anything on the USB?
And where's the USB coming in? Here?
We would see the USB here if it was.
All right, can we get some talking in once more?
Can you hear me in there?
I can.
I'm seeing something right there.
It's good.
For the folks on Zoom, I think that they're just having some technical difficulties in the room in Rockefeller getting our audio to play out to the room instead of just over a laptop. So just bear with them for a few more minutes as they do finish the technical.
Weird workaround. If I. Yeah. Not a great workaround yet, but if I take laptop in the other room and turn my computer on and I put a lab.
Yeah, for me too.
I mean, it's 10 after 3.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think you're just going to have to monitor a chat from in here.
Yeah, I'd say do that. So set that up with this one. Okay. Just take one of these.
Is there a network connection
in there?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, we can take them.
Okay. We'll see how that goes.
Yep.
Can we do that?
Okay, I just need a laugh.
Yeah. What is the
so we can't hear anybody over Zoom right now.
Yeah.
They will be seeing and hearing you.
Yeah.
So we can work it out for now.
Great. And then can you get the people over Zoom just on a computer speaker?
Yeah, we're gonna set that up in the other room. And he's gonna hook a mic up to us so we can hear it in the room.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So it's a little bit of a rough workaround, but we're doing it.
So should we go ahead and get started?
Yes.
Can
Okay. All set? Okay. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. Apologize for the delay, and I just want to give our thanks to the folks at CIT. They had a very abbreviated time to set things up today because there was a class in here just before. So today is the orientation for the Faculty Senate. Let's see. Oh, am I not controlling slides? Sure. Great. Next slide, please. So I'd like to start with the land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayakono, the Cuyuga Nation. The Gayakono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayakono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayakono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Next slide, please. So our agenda today is just a sort of quick overview of kind of where we sit as a Senate in shared governance. A bit of introductions, myself, the Associate Dean of Faculty, the Speaker of the Senate, and then the chairs of all the Senate committees, who are going to talk a little bit about what those Senate committees do. Then Sam, the Speaker, and I are going to talk a little bit about the Senate functions and procedures. And everybody lost video. And then we'll have time for discussion and questions. Jill, next slide. So at Cornell University, we have about 1,700 tenure track faculty members and about 1,300 research, teaching, and extension faculty, almost 1,000 emeriti associated with the university. Across three campuses, 13 schools, 88 departments. So it's a big organization, lots of people with interests who it is our responsibility to try to capture and represent the university administration. There's 135 of us and 11 committees and two working groups to accomplish this task. In terms of our overall structure, there's some of our membership that is elected by the entire faculty. So that includes the Dean of Faculty, currently me, Chris Schaefer, faculty member in the Biomedical Engineering Department, and the Associate Dean of Faculty, Adam Smith, who I'll let introduce himself in just a minute. Also elected from across the entire university is the University Faculty Committee. Could anybody who is a member of the University Faculty Committee just raise their hand and let folks know who you are? Okay, it's me in here. Great. The University Faculty Committee is an important committee. It meets every couple of weeks. It is one of the main things this committee does is it sets the agenda for the Senate. It also meets with the President and Provost and sort of serves as that communication step between the senior administration and the faculty. Adam Smith chairs the Nominations and Elections Committee, which is tasked with staffing other Senate committees, and I'll let Adam talk a little bit about that. There are a few at-large senator seats. And then somewhat uniquely, Cornell elects two members of the faculty to serve as trustees, currently Tara Holm and Durva Ghosh. Beyond that, there are voting members of the Senate that are elected by department or at the college level for research, teaching, and extension faculty. So there's folks from every department. Depending on the size of the department, you would have one or two senators. The Cornell academics and professors emeriti have a Senate seat, as does the library. And then one more elected position is the Speaker of the Senate, for whom the Senate itself elects it. We have Sam Nelson as our presumptive electee in waiting. and will handle his appointment at the start of the first Senate meeting. Next slide. So just kind of looking at how all of this sits, the sort of top bar there are folks who have some fraction of our time is officially associated with Dean of Faculty office. So the Dean of Faculty is a 50% appointment for me. Associate Dean of Faculty is a 25% appointment for Adam Smith. There's three staff members in the department, two full-time, Jill Short and C.A. Sugar, and one half-time, Melissa Rupledge. Jill, do you want to quickly say what folks are doing? Okay. So Jill is the executive staff assistant. C.A. Sugar helps with a lot of scheduling, and Melissa works quite a bit to organize the Cornell Academics and Professors Emeriti activities. Want to emphasize that the staff is the sort of permanent residence of the Dean of Faculty office, while Adam and I are transient helpers, and Jill really serves as an incredible source of institutional memory. It's essential to the function of this office. University Faculty and Nominations and Elections Committee that, again, I just talked about, and then, oh, I'm sorry, previous slide. No problem. And then there are a set of several, so there's the Faculty Senate, and then these 11 Senate committees. Everyone serving on the University Faculty Committee, Nominations and Elections Committee, everybody is a senator, and folks serving on all of these Senate committees are volunteering their time. This is a form of university service, but I think it's important for us all to recognize that we're here helping with this in a voluntary capacity, outside those of us who have a little bit of an appointment. Great, next slide. So at this point, do we now have capability to hear folks who are on Zoom? Are we able to hear folks on Zoom? Yeah. Yeah. Adam, can we?
Can you hear me?
Very quietly.
Do you want me? Would it help if I speak up?
That works great. So with that, Adam, I'd like to let you have folks introduce to the different committee chairs and have them talk about their committees.
Sure, that'd be a pleasure. So thank you, Chris. We have, as Chris noted, a remarkable assembly of really important and faculty senate committees that are engaged in the work of collaborative governance in important ways every year. So my name, by the way, is Adam Smith. I'm a professor in anthropology and the elected associate dean of the faculty. This is my second year. So we're just going to go down this list. Some of the people are there in the room. I think some are on Zoom. And then I'm going to take a couple of people, those descriptions for a couple of committees for people who couldn't come. So Bob, can we start with you?
Hey, good afternoon. My name's Bob Weiss. I'm a professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine. I also serve as Senior Associate Dean in the Graduate School, and I have the good fortune of chairing the A.D. White Professor at Large Selection Committee, and there's a couple of fellow committee members, Kareem and Lisa, here as well, and I know also some hosts of A.D. White professors. I view this as kind of a signature program at the university. The program was established at the 100th anniversary of the university, and is really designed to help Cornell in its kind of rural upstate location stay engaged with the broader academic world. So we bring in the foremost scholars, artists, thinkers to come to Cornell. It's a bit of a unique program in the sense that the faculty that are appointed for professors at large really get true faculty appointments at Cornell that get approved by the president and appointed by the Board of Trustees. The faculty have 6-year appointments, and during that time, they come for at least 2-week-long visits. These are kind of immersive visits, so we really are looking to bring in the highest caliber scholars and people that kind of broadly appeal and can engage across the university in all disciplines. So we have 80 white professors in the arts, humanities, social sciences, physical sciences, and life sciences. And the committee has kind of two main roles. One is the selection process. So the committee reviews and advances nominations of scholars that we consider appropriate for this program. And then secondly, we engage with the visiting faculty, as we hope all faculty at Cornell do. And I think I'll be back to the Faculty Senate next week to talk a little bit more about our nomination and selection process, as well as our kind of fall calendar. So I'll just leave it at that then for the description for today. Thank you.
Kareem, are you there?
Sorry, Adam, we couldn't quite hear you then. So next would be Kareem from Library Board.
Good afternoon, Senators. Thank you for the opportunity to address you this afternoon. I have prepared my comments so I don't get distracted. I'm the chair of the Faculty Library Board. My name is Karim Ali Kassim. I'm a professor in the School of Global Development and the Environment and the American Indian and Indigenous Studies Program. The Faculty Library Board consists of 10 faculty from all the colleges representing diversity of disciplines and perspectives. We also have one undergraduate and one graduate student. Our charge is to formulate broad library policy, represent the interest of the libraries to the faculty as well as to the university administration, keep the university librarian informed of the needs and concerns of the faculty and students while maintaining and promoting the welfare of the university libraries. I hope you're noting that I am using plural libraries. The Cornell University Library is everywhere. It exists physically and digitally in the communication networks of faculty and students. It transcends historical time and physical space from rare collections to digital collections. The 18 libraries can be accessed in person, at their location, or electronically from anywhere there is a network service in the world. The library is literally Cornell's circulatory system. It secures the health and well-being of the organic body called Cornell. Like fish in water or humans with air, many faculty and students do not recognize the significance of the university library system to their scholarly life. A key future role for the Faculty Library Board will be to bring this consciousness to fellow faculty and students, as well as the tax-paying citizens of New York. I will return to this in my conclusion in my short presentation. In the past year, the Faculty Library Board focused on the financial and structural challenges rooted in the extortive actions of the oligarchic concentration of academic publishing. In spring 2026, the Faculty Library Board focused on scenarios of practical action necessary to respond to the academic publishing challenges. You must be aware of the recent survey aimed at faculty for priority subscription of Elsevier journals, as there will be need to limit the number of titles the library can license. Since August 10th, the online journal survey was distributed to 20,000 faculty, graduate students, and professional students, as well as postdocs all across all the Cornell campuses. As of August 28th, 2,700 have responded to the survey. We hope that there will be more. Looking forward, the Cornell Library faces financial challenges in academic publishing, funding cuts resulting from the current U.S. administration, and Cornell's budgetary constraints. Conversely, at this time of political and economic besiegement, there is need to inform New York and U.S. citizenry of the ethical role and value of the informed intellect to effective functioning of pluralistic, democratic societies in the United States. My own considered impression is that august bodies such as the Cornell University Senate are very good at pontificating, but ultimately ineffective at tangible actions in the trenches to address the overdetermined crisis that the university library system has been facing for the past decade. A self-serving, instrumental approach to our library is tantamount to blindness that will be perilous to our intellectual and democratic stability in Tompkins County, New York State, and the United States. Together, through value-driven pragmatism, we need to undertake strategic and tactical action to deal with the hegemon who has no shame. Thank you for the opportunity to address you this afternoon.
Thanks very much. Let's see. Adam, why don't we see if you're...
Tracy Sokol, I believe, is on Zoom with me here.
Yeah, very quiet still. Let's see. Do we have Tracy Sokol? Tracy
on Zoom.
Okay. Tom is also, and Jillian. So next would be, so we're going to skip while we're working on sound. So next, I chair the Faculty Committee on Tenure Appointments, the FACTA Committee. This is a critical committee that looks at each tenure case and each promotion to full professor case that comes through the university and provides, after it comes out of the colleges, and provides advice to the provost before she makes her final decision. Let's see, Ashley? On Zoom. Don? Great.
Thank you. So I'm Don Finkel. I'm a professor in economics through the Brooks School of Public Policy, and I'm the chair of the Financial Policies Committee. And I think actually a lot of what we do is sort of summed up right there in the title, as well as there's a very nice set of descriptions on the web page for us, you know, that we try to track financial policies of Cornell. We try to work with the administration with their budget planning, and in all that we're kind of focused, I guess I would say, sort of a conduit between the faculty and the financial parts of the administration. Right? We see, for example, we look over the budgets and get a sense of how the budgets are doing and where the big threats are and where things are looking good, et cetera. And that way, but we always try to bring that faculty perspective. One thing I want to be sure to mention before I lose my track of my comments is that very much appreciate input from the Senate. We try to represent faculty views to the financial administration of Cornell, but actually we're only 11 faculty members there, so we really value input from the broader set of people in the Senate, as well as anywhere else in the university. I was saying, you know, one thing we get a view of are a phrase I heard a lot over the last couple of years, that first they started talking about the financial headwinds that Cornell faced. And then in January of 2025, those headwinds seemed to turn into something somewhat more dramatic than a headwind. Felt like more like a gale force winds at times. So a lot of what we were talking about last year were how those various threats, pretty big threats to Cornell's finances played out. You know, we're we saw the settlement with the federal funding. I think there's still a lot of uncertainty about what's going on with the financial implications of what's going on with international students. And then if you noticed, there's a, over the summer, there was a legal settlement that Cornell Weill had that was a large amount of money, $1 billion, that was settled for some sexual abuse problems there. So we were sort of tracking all that. And we were also tracking Resilient Cornell, the efforts to bring the budget into having a bigger margin between revenues and cost, because historically for the past 5 years, a number of years, and pretty thin margins, and only small things had to go wrong for Cornell not to be in the black anymore. One really useful goal was the financial administration, administrators at BP, calculated or did a nice benchmarking exercise with other universities and realized that our peers have better margins, and so gave us something to shoot for. So we'll continue to be monitoring, you know, sort of what's happening as in the next steps of Resilient Cornell, the next steps of the planning for the future of the American university, the financial implications again. We're also very interested in the budget model, by which I mean the way tuition dollars are allocated to colleges and colleges based on their students enrolled in the college, as well as the credit hours taught, because of, there's a lot of concern, I think, that that system has, while it's doing some good things, it's also created some unintended consequences in the form of incentives for units to be competing with each other rather than cooperating with each other to provide the best education we can. I think what some of the other topics, I think that gives you a, I hope that gives you a flavor of the types of things the Financial Policies Committee discusses. We're also kind of looking forward to working with Chris Schaefer more on reporting and providing reports and background on upcoming initiatives or Senate proposals to kind of, again, provide that faculty background, but of a group of faculty that have, by now, most of us have accumulated a fair amount of understanding of what's going on with the university budget. Thank you.
Great. So let's see, Jenny?
Hi everyone, I'm Jenny Goldstein, a professor in Global Development and the Environment at the Ashley School. I'm chair of the University Lectures Committee, which is, compared to the last one, a fun one. Basically, the University Lectures are the highest level of distinguished visiting scholars that we host here on campus. They're intended to bring people together, students and faculty from multiple units. We have two different series. The University Lectures are $5,000 for a single lecture, so someone from external to campus to come just for a day or two, and the $5,000 covers honorarium, a reception, and a dinner, plus some student engagement, if you want to include that. We also have the Messenger Lecture Series, which is either $10,000 to host someone to come for three lectures, or $20,000 for someone to come for six lectures over multiple visits, and the same thing would be included honorarium and receptions and dinners and all the like. I'll talk more about this next week in our nomination process. We have a deadline in both the fall and the spring, and it's a two-part nomination. So the first is the intent to nominate someone. We just require an email, really, with a sort of brief description, and then a full nomination package several weeks later. And I guess the most important thing to keep in mind is that what we look for is having multiple faculty from across different colleges and departments sponsor and recommend a particular speaker. So we're really looking for people who can go beyond their area of expertise, specialization, and speak to a more kind of general audience, or do both in separate lectures, and also try to engage with students. So they don't have to be necessarily distinguished faculty from other universities. We're hosting some journalists this year, and we're open to other types of people. We've had artists as well and some popular authors. So I'll share more about the talks we're hosting this year next week, and that's it. I should also say we work very closely with Jill Short, so if you interact with us, send us emails, you'll probably also speak to her. So thanks a lot.
Great. Great. Lee?
Good afternoon. My name is Lee Humphreys. I am professor and currently chair of the Department of Communication in CALS. I am the chair of the University ROTC Relations Committee. Our committee's charge is to serve as the Educational Policy Committee and Hearing Board for the program, and we review all ROTC instructional appointments. So all instructors with ROTC are given often visiting lecturer and academic appointments while they are here instructing in military sciences, and our committee meets with them and approves each of them. So for those of you who might not know, the history of the military science at Cornell dates back to the founding of the university as part of the Morrell Act, which gave Cornell the land and established the university. It was also built into that Cornell offer military tactics and science to all students. In 1916, Congress officially created the Reserve Officers Training Corps in the National Defense Act. And there have been a number of notable Cornellians serving and leading in the military. Just one of note is Colonel Frank A. Barton. You might recognize the name. He was class of 1891. Originally built from 1914 to 1917, the U.S. State Armory and Drill Hall was later renamed Barton Hall in 1940 after Colonel Barton. We are today the only Ivy League to represent all branches of the military. So that is it's the Army and the Navy and the Air Force. You might see cadets and midshipmen around campus from the Marine Corps and Space Force as well. And so it is a long-standing relationship that we are quite proud of. Thank you.
Great. Roger?
Hello, I'm Roger Gilbert. I teach in the Department of Literatures and English, and I chair the Faculty Committee on Music, which is a very long-standing committee whose role has been somewhat nebulous and has changed a lot as, the needs of the music program here have changed. But our main purpose, as I understand it, is to serve as a bridge between the Cornell Concert Series and the Cornell community and faculty at large. The Cornell Concert Series is, of course, a world-class series of concerts that are offered every year. We try to be a resource to the music department, which oversees and manages the series. We help out as we can with publicity, with funding, with other issues. We provide some advice. We don't do any of the programming. That's entirely done by staff and faculty in music. But we offer ourselves as a kind of sounding board and, as I say, as a bridge to the community at large. You may have noticed, if you looked at the announcement of the upcoming schedule for the concert series, that it's been scaled back significantly, and that's for budgetary reasons. So one thing I'm hoping this committee can do is to help in whatever way we can to bring the concert series back to the level it's been at in the past. That said, we continue to have what has evolved to be a really well-balanced mix of programming that sort of equal parts classical music, jazz and American roots music, and world music, and that's still represented in the upcoming season. I see a hand back there.
It is being worked on.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually not an issue of being able to afford to bring in more acts. It's more of a more ensembles and performers and so on. It's a much more specific problem that I think can be addressed in the next year. I hope very much so anyway. We will tell you what to do. Yes. Okay. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. And is Kim or John from RTE Working Group here? No, maybe on Zoom. Okay. Adam, do you want to see if we can hear you again?
Let's give this another try. Can you hear me now?
Just speak as loudly as you can, and we'll catch it a little bit.
Okay. All right. Let me do three things as quickly as possibly I can. I'll first try and announce the Committee on Academic Programs and Policies. This is a committee that's led by Tom Papinski, and he sent me the following comments to share with all of you. He says that CAP is responsible for hearing concerns and reviewing proposals about all academic programs that cross schools or colleges. One of our central responsibilities is to screen and offer feedback on proposals for new academic programs, and over the past several years, this has been our major focus. CAP's members are drawn from across the university and work together collaboratively to provide honest and constructive feedback on matters that come before it. We look forward to working together with the Faculty Senate in support of strong faculty governance at Cornell. So I want to reiterate CAP is a very important Faculty Senate committee. I was also sent a blurb and apologies from Jillian Goldfarb that she couldn't be there. And Jillian is the chair of the Educational Policy Committee, so let me read to you what she said. The Educational Policy Committee, or EPC, is responsible for reviewing and recommending university-wide academic policies that affect instruction across colleges, schools, and academic units. Areas under EPC's purview include grading policies, examination policies, academic requirements, the academic calendar, class scheduling, and hours of instruction. During the current academic year, the committee is considering several issues, including a proposal to revise the university's add-drop deadline, and discussions surrounding the role of artificial intelligence in grading and assessment practices. Through these efforts, EPC helps ensure that academic policies remain effective, equitable, and responsive to the evolving needs of students and faculty. Let me close then with a little plug about the committee of the Faculty Senate that I lead. As the Associate Dean of Faculty, I'm tasked with chairing the Nominations and Elections Committee. We think of this committee as the leading edge of Cornell's faculty governance, as it's really through nominations and elections that we constitute the committees of the Senate that represent faculty views in university deliberations. This committee also works with committees to ensure that they are chaired by faculty who can coordinate their actions and then set the agenda and serve as a resource for any ad hoc committees that might come along during the course of events. This year, we're taking a look as well at some policy-related issues related to the election process and committee organizations that we hope to bring to the Senate in the fullness of time. I want to note for those of you who have been asked to serve that time spent on a university committee is a fascinating insight into the working of the university. And so I want to ask all of you to think about the Senate committees that are perhaps most in your interest space. And also to keep an ear out for the voices that we really need to be guiding the university. At any moment, you are free to send me their names, pass along the names to an NNE member. You can also just send a vague description of someone, maybe a photo. I could geolocate their office, whatever it takes to help us find people who we really need to be participating in these faculty senate committees. That's all I have, Chris. Back to you.
And then I think we have Tracy Skokel and then Ashley Newman on Zoom. Tracy, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Okay.
Hi, everybody. I am the chair of the committee with a long name. That's Academic Freedom and Professional Status of Faculty. And we consist of 9 members, including myself. And we are drawn from all units at the university, which makes it a very diverse and fantastic committee to work with. And what we do is we address any issues related to the process of tenure and come up with issues, and we are brought to our attention that there are issues with the tenure process, or we proactively come up with things that we would like to see altered and submit a resolution to the Faculty Senate for consideration. An example of the latter is the collaborative scholarship, which was born out of the committee's discussions and is hopefully being implemented at all the units around the university. Other items come to our attention through any faculty member in the university can request that we look into certain items. That's usually done via the Dean of Faculty, who then will distribute it to the appropriate committees if an item comes up. We also serve as the appeals committee after most appeals have run their course at the different colleges, although this does vary depending on the nature of the appeal. For instance, if there is a grievance at a certain college and the faculty and the grievance at the college has run its course, then we may be the last committee that evaluates that particular grievance. And I think that's, so professional status of faculty is a very broad term that again encompasses academic freedom and also the student and teacher relationships. So happy to answer any questions if anyone has any.
Great, thank you. Ashley?
Hey, I will try to speak up. Hopefully you can hear me. It looks like I may win for the longest committee title, and that is the Faculty Advisory Committee on Athletics and Physical Education, and we call it FACAPE for short to help with that. So as the name implies, we deal with programs of athletics and phys ed and how they best complement and support the overall educational objective of the university. Our committee has 9 faculty members, and just last semester we updated our bylaws to not only include the 2 Red Key Honor Society co-presidents, which is the Varsity Athletics Honor Society, but also the 2 co-presidents of SAC, which is the Student Athlete Advisory Committee, which every NCAA institution is mandated to have a SAC on their campus, in addition to all the conferences and divisions having a SAC. So we have those students, as well as representation from the Student Assembly and Graduate and Professional Student Assembly. So lots of student voices. And then in addition to faculty and students, we also have ex officio and non-voting members who are part of our committee and obviously very important for the work that we do. So that includes the director of athletics, the director of physical education and recreational services. We also have as ex officio our faculty athletic representative, or the FAR, which every NCAA institution has one, and ours is John Sippel. And then we also have a senior deputy athletic director for the student athlete experience and another student athlete support services administrator. So we have a large diverse committee of faculty, students, as well as administration in athletics and phys ed. And so our committee, we updated our charges last semester as well in a resolution, so you can refer to that on the Faculty Senate website, but really to more update it for the work that we do, because FACAPE was established in 1987, and as you can imagine, a lot's changed with NCAA athletics and physical education at the university level. So as chair, much of the work that I do is reviewing the missed class timesheets that are provided to me from Student Athlete Services. So first, the coaching staff puts together their schedule. It obviously has budgetary considerations, things like that. It gets approved through their means, and then I see it as the last step to make sure that they are in compliance with our FACAPE missed class time policy. So we try to limit missed class time to 5 days per semester. And so we go back and forth to try to make sure that we can do the best we can with that. And so as faculty, if you're teaching any varsity student athletes in your class, they will hopefully be showing you that so they can have those conversations earlier in the semester to try to make sure that arrangements can be made if they're missing any class time where attendance is relevant and mandated, or prelims, assignments, things of that nature. If there's any issues, don't hesitate to email me as well as Lindsay Hansen in Student Athlete Support Services. So that's a big part of our work. We also oversee the physical education and the swim graduation requirement, but that is really not much involvement of us because students complete that, and there are very rare exceptions or that we hear as a committee. And then we also try to really form good relationships and try to make faculty liaisons with teams and help support that, so that way these student athletes have the ability to have mentorship and relationships with faculty all across campus and feel supported and have those types of relationships. So I think that's about everything I have, but again, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Ashley. Next slide. So I just want to say very quickly, you know, working in the Senate, you'll see a broad variety of different issues that you're asked to think about. Everything from, as we say, procedural things like updating the bylaws of BACAPE, establishing new faculty lines, to looking at issues of how the campus code is organized and things like that on campus. So can be a very broad kind of role. Next slide. We also do a lot of having senior administrators and other folks at campus come and inform the Senate about things that are happening, with the goal of this being a communication channel that brings ideas back down to the faculty. Next slide. Cornell is somewhat unique in the extensiveness of the shared governance system that we have. There's five different assemblies: an employee assembly, an undergraduate student assembly, graduate student assembly, the faculty senate, and then the university assembly, which sort of considers matters that span all of those constituencies. And the faculty senate itself has over the last 26 years, passed a number of resolutions sort of making points about the role of shared governance in helping the university make the best decisions. I was just checking, I thought RESA was a sponsor of the most recent resolution, 107, but I checked and I think you just spoke in its favor, but you're not actually listed as a sponsor. But RESA's long been an advocate for improved shared governance here at Cornell. Next slide, please. So I just want to take a few minutes now and kind of talk about like how things are going to run in the Senate. So prior to a faculty Senate meeting, as I said earlier, the University Faculty Committee will set the agenda, and that'll be posted the Friday before the meeting at the latest. So day after tomorrow, we'll post the Senate meeting for next week. And there are places for comments there. So beginning as soon as that agenda goes up there, we welcome germane comments to be posted to that page. And then if you do intend to do any motion at the Senate meeting, we definitely encourage you to reach out and let us know so that we can think about and understand how that would impact the agenda and the efficient use of our time. Next slide. So I'm going to ask future speaker Sam Nelson to come up and talk with us about how things will run during a Senate meeting.
Thank you, Chris. My name is Sam Nelson. I teach in ILR. I'm also the director of the Speech and Debate Program here at Cornell, which includes a parliamentary debate program, a policy debate program, a speech program, and a Spanish language debate program, which we're very proud of. I've held this position before many years ago, and I'm happy to come back if I'm approved at our next meeting. Let me just quickly go over what I think is important. First of all, it's very important that we have quorum, and that means 50% of the senators are actually voting. You can't pass something with less than 50%. The other thing that I want to sort of point out very quickly is that there are some main guiding principles that if any of these principles are violated, something's wrong. And there is a 576-page Robert's Rules of Orders, which we follow, but these principles are encapsulated. And so I can find the part of the Robert's Rules of Orders that has been violated if any of these guiding principles have, in your opinion, or you can come to an agreement, are not being upheld. First one, everyone has the right to participate in the discussion, and if they wish, they're not required to, and anyone may speak, cannot speak a second time unless everybody that's wanted to speak the first time has been able to. One of the unique things my experience has been with the Faculty Senate is we have a limited amount of time to get the meeting done, so we limit the amount of time a person can speak to 2 minutes so that one person doesn't speak for a lot and then there's no time left for anybody else to speak. This has led to some complaints in the past, but 2 minutes is what we can do right now to do it efficiently. It doesn't mean that you are cut off and you'll never have an opportunity to speak again. We just want to hear from everybody at least one time before we hear from someone a second time. The other principle that everyone has the right to know what is going on at all times. You don't, only urgent matters may interrupt the speaker. So if you're confused as to what's going on, like you think something's not being handled right, or maybe that first principle is being violated, you have the right to be like, what are we doing here? You know, and we'll explain it the best we can. Could you scroll down a little bit? There's only one thing, this is very important, only one thing, only one motion can be discussed at one time. This is probably the most important thing, because if you don't do this, you get a lot of confusion. And I've seen this happen in my past time as the speaker, where people are talking about two different things, but then maybe the third person that speaks isn't sure which one they're referring to, and it causes general confusion. So we generally just try to deal with one issue at a time, and it's probably the most important a way to efficiently run the meeting. That's basically it. Thanks.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Sam. Next slide. Just as a, this is a link to a, or a, there is a link associated with this introduction to a two-page summary of Robert's Rules of Order, a sort of simplified version that that I think Sam likes to use, so you're welcome to take a look at this. Next slide. As Sam said, we'll have try to limit folks to just a couple of minutes. If your faculty are always welcome, and all faculty are welcome to speak at the Senate meeting, guests are welcome as well, but we would like guests to let us know at the Dean of Faculty Office if they're coming. We do have a brief 5 minutes time set aside for good of the order, which is meant to be a more last-minute opportunity for faculty to address the Senate. We ask that you'd reach out to the Dean of Faculty Office at least one day before the meeting to let us know, again, so that we can allocate appropriate time. Voting on issues will typically occur electronically, beginning about a month after the issue is first presented at the Senate. That should give time after the issue is presented for you to consult colleagues, to read public comments, and come to a decision about how you'd like to vote on the issue. Next slide, please. After the meeting, the role of a faculty senator does not end when the meeting ends and you walk out the door. We would like you to be very active in communicating with your constituency. We are going to do a lot to try to tee this up and help you look really good to your constituency. So first, I will produce and a synopsis of the Senate meeting, and I'll forward it to all senators.
I'm going to ask that every senator then editorialize my synopsis and forward it to everybody in your department. Let people know the parts that are relevant for them, your opinions on it, how you intend to vote, ask for their feedback on issues, and forward that that note on to folks in your unit. I'm also going to ask senators who are affiliated with departments in particular units to schedule time at your monthly or bi-monthly or however often you meet as a faculty or a group, and going to ask you to present some issues that come before the Senate to your faculty. Again, we are going to tee this up so that you look really good. You will have heard the presentation in the faculty Senate meeting. We'll provide you with the slide decks. In some cases, there'll be a video of someone else giving the talk, so you could present the video and just answer questions. Next week, you're going to hear about a couple of things we want you to do this way. One is broadly advertising the University Messenger and A.D. White lectures that are coming up for this semester. These are meant to be university-wide. We want everybody to know about them. There are also very big changes in the academic integrity reporting system that have been put in place as of last week. These have been worked on very hard over the last couple of years, but they are now in place, and we want to make sure that all faculty have an understanding of what has changed, the new opportunities for addressing more minor instances of academic misconduct through the accepting responsibility system, and the broad academic integrity reporting system that helps the university keep track of folks who may be multiple offenders. So we're going to ask both of those issues be things that you take back to the Senate. The issues that were presented to Senate, again, will be posted on the Senate website, and there's opportunity for ongoing public comment. There will be a transcript of the Senate that'll be posted for review and approval. Things that pass become part of the resolution archive. The goal here is transparency and opportunities for comment at all stages of consideration of an issue. Next slide, please. The last thing I'll say is just the steps required to place a motion. Any senator is welcome to initiate an issue. We do not have to just be reactive. In fact, in identifying issues and being proactive at bringing them forward to this body is exactly what we would like to see happen. There's basically four different ways that something can come to the Senate and be above threshold for the Senate to be required to consider it. So something coming from a faculty committee, from the university faculty committee, by any four senators who endorse a resolution, or by any 25 members of the faculty, even if they're not senators. Once a motion is placed, the university faculty committee and I are considering, and you will hear more about next week, a process of automatic referral to committee where issues that are brought to the Senate would first be sent to an appropriate committee for substantive analysis and comment, and what comes back to the Senate would be the sponsor and the report and recommendation on the issue from the Senate committee. That's something we will decide together whether or not to implement, and I'll be talking about it at the next Senate meeting. Motions for consideration will be posted in pending legislation at least a week before the meeting, with an opportunity for public comment. And then we will vote on the resolution not during the period of time immediately after its presentation in the Senate, but we'll present it in the Senate. We'll wait a month while open comments. We will mention at the next Senate meeting that it's coming up for a vote, and then the votes will be immediately after that. The goal of that is to provide time for you to consult with colleagues, read comments, and think about how you want to weigh in on an issue. Final slide. So this is just upcoming meeting dates. You should have received invitations to all of them. They'll be held here with the same hybrid format. We ask that you, when you walk in, if you're in person, find the sign-in sheet and add your name and department. If you're joining on Zoom, please add your name and department to the chat. The last thing I want to mention is tomorrow, beginning at 4 p.m., there's a reception with the president and the provost for members of the Faculty Senate, the Employee Assembly, and the University Assembly. And I hope you'll be able to make it and interact with your fellow Senate colleagues and members of these other august bodies. Is that the last slide? Very good. So thank you so much. I apologize for us running a few minutes over. If there are any broad questions that folks feel would be applicable for everyone to hear, I'm happy to answer it. Otherwise, happy to stick around for a few minutes and address questions individually. Please, and if you wouldn't mind just coming up so we can get the question on the recording. Just name and department so people know.
Hi, I'm Ariana Kim from Music. I just had a question about the schedule. I noticed that there are those reserve dates, and on the website it shows possible extra meeting dates. Just wondering what might require that and when we'll know to put those on the calendar.
Thank you. So the question is about, the Senate has a two slots a month that are held for Senate meetings. We schedule a meeting every month. That alternative slot is held in reserve for things that run past on a particular Senate meeting, a fast-moving issue, or perhaps what's called a faculty forum, where we have a less formal kind of meeting where we are exploring in depth a discussion of some issue. I'm already talking with Steve Jackson about a faculty forum later this fall on the impact of generative artificial intelligence on assessment of student learning. So, that would be an example of a topic that I think could be valuable. In terms of when those decisions will be made, we'll probably be waiting until, a couple of weeks before we would cancel any of these reserved meetings, just so that we can maintain that flexibility in case we need it. Okay, great. Thank you all so much for coming to this orientation. I hope this was useful. And again, I hope we'll see you all tomorrow at 4 o'clock at the reception. Have a good afternoon.